So, okay, thank you very much. What I'm talking about today is my own puzzlement. When I was reading Yeats for the millionth time, I had already written a dissertation on Yeats, taught Yeats for many years, written many essays on Yeats, and I don't know how it escaped me as a question, but it did escape me why he was using the forms he did in the poems as he did. Most of the, today I'm just restricting myself to two sequences, but most of the poems in sequences, as you know, in English, have all the poems alike, whether it's Shakespeare's sonnets or Meredith's quasi-sequence Modern Love that has 16-line poems, but they're all the same. A couple of Shakespeare's sonnets depart from that, as you all know, but basically the idea of a sequence was a lot of poems that looked just the same in form. And then I began to notice that Yeats's sequences did not look the same in form. On the contrary, they seemed to have a very erratic set of rules for putting poems together. You'd have a short poem, then you'd have a long poem, then you'd have a poem that rhymed this way, and you'd have a poem that rhymed that way. Then you'd have a poem, the rule of which seemed to be that every stanza had to be a single sentence, but other things in the same sequence weren't obeying that rule. So I began to think there must be, it can't be random, there must be some method in his madness, which I had discovered earlier by treating separate other forms that he used, such as ottava rima or the sonnet. So I set myself to think about, people had taken it for granted that Yeats was just putting down whatever he wanted to, but I thought he was more methodical than that, and so I started thinking about the sequences, and why the poems are as they are, and more importantly, why they're in the order they're in. Could they be rearranged? Could you put poem 5 where poem 2 is? Or could you put poem 6 where poem 3 is? And if not, why not? Weren't they all still there? If you had the 7 poems and you, instead of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you did 1, 2, 4, 3, 7, 6, 5 or something. So that was baffling to me as well. And I felt that there was an implicit argument going through the sequences that was carried on by the fact that it began with this and ended at that and did that in the middle, so that I felt that whatever the argument of the sequence was, it was implicitly being carried by the order of the separate poems in the sequence. This had not interested anybody before me, as far as I can see. And the precision that Professor Smith spoke of, thank you. The precision comes from my having done science as an undergraduate, I think. I mean, it teaches you admirably how to be exact and also how to muster evidence for whatever you're going to assert. So I hope to muster evidence and show you the way I see these poems. Oh, did I take my own handout? No, I left my own handout on the table, did I? Okay. Did I not? Thanks. I must put away my distraction. Thank you very much. So, my plan is to talk about this first sequence in detail, about the second very cursorily, but to speak about them as I go along reading the part that I'm going to be talking about. Rather than reading the whole poem, all 6 parts of it, I will speak about the whole, then about part 1 while reading part 1, part 2 while reading part 2, and so on. 1919 that you have before you was a long 6-part sequence of 130 lines. That is, it's a work too massive to be understood immediately or without, I think, much reflection. There were guerrilla conflicts in Ireland between 1919 and 1920. Later, those conflicts were to break out in a form of civil war in Ireland with the Free Staters against the Republicans. Eventually, the Free Staters won, installed the Republic, and the Republicans, many of them, were executed for wanting to continue fighting until England gave in and made Ireland a united country. But before the civil war that allowed for the partition of, finally settled before the partition of Ireland with the northern 6 counties and the southern counties incorporated as the Republic of Ireland and the north still belonging to England, as you know. Before that, the English were trying to keep down what they rightly perceived as a rebellion, and unfortunately it was done not only under military auspices and police auspices, but also the English had brought along a motley crew of people known as the Black and Tans from their uniform, who were mostly demobilized soldiers from the First World War, who had been given no police training at all. So they acted like soldiers, and there were lots of atrocities and tragedies and so on. One of those atrocities committed by the Black and Tans is at the heart of this sequence. That actual event, which is mentioned in part one, bursts in, as we'll see, on the illusions of the past, and this is the only mention of the atrocity in the whole sequence. Lady Gregory, Yeats's friend, Lady Gregory's journal entry of November 5th, 1920, records this event. Eileen Quinn, a young mother of three, was shot dead with her child in her arms by Black and Tan soldiers shooting from a passing lorry. And that was right in Yeats's neighborhood. Later, his own house was shot into in Dublin. We might at first think that the whole of 1919 was written to show that actual event, but it occupies only these few lines in stanza four. Now days are dragon-ridden, the nightmare rides upon sleep, a drunken soldiery can leave the mother murdered at her door to crawl in her own blood, and go scot-free. That's it. The rest of the sequence doesn't talk about that anymore. I'll read the whole first one in a moment. Another poet might have made much more of the local bloodshed and might have investigated the historical causes of the present tragedy. Yeats neither begins nor ends with the event, nor does he treat it in any historical detail. Irish events, it's usually been considered a document of that guerrilla warfare. Irish events, though they stimulated, obviously, 1919, are not Yeats's principal focus within the sequence. It is the enigma of human violence that is his subject. That is, it broadens out, as we'll see, far beyond Ireland. Why, for instance, to leap to the last enigma, if you turn to the last poem, poem six on the next page, why to leap to the last enigma of 1919, would the 14th century high-born Lady Alice Cutler abase herself to the evil spirit, Yeats's words, Robert Artison, and bring him by way of erotic offerings the red combs sliced off the head of her cocks? That is not nice, you know? And that kind of violence plays its role here too, and in fact is the crowning piece of violence in the whole. And it goes back several centuries to the 14th century, so it's by no means just occupied with 20th century Ireland. Why, to return to the first enigma of the sequence, and here I'm summarizing poem one, which I'm about to read, why would anyone in ancient Greece become such an incendiary or bigot, Yeats's words, that he would burn religious monuments, sacred monuments, or melt down artworks, complicated artworks, for their commercial value as gold? It isn't solely or even chiefly political violence that perplexes Yeats in 1919. It's rather the recurrent, multiform, and age-old violence of human beings, even if only the violence of animal sacrifice, that he investigates here. It is misleading to consider 1919 only in the context of contemporary Irish conflicts, where it's usually considered. Yeats himself takes pains to widen the historical context within the sequence, ranging as far back as ancient Greece in the burning of the statue of Athena on the Parthenon, and ancient Palestine in his reference to the decapitation of John the Baptist after Salome's dance. The carnage in Ireland occasioned this sequence, but its individual poems are neither comprehended nor exhausted by the events that prompted them. The originating enigma of 1919 is the human race's urge to obliterate the very civilizations it has painstakingly constructed. We might say, says Yeats, we might expect common things to be pitched about by violence that happens under the moon, everything under the moon subject to change, everything over the moon not. But surely fate would protect from such violence the ingenious, lovely things that human beings have created. Religious icons such as the olive wood image of Athena on the Acropolis, and artworks such as the ivory sculpture of Phidias, or the inspired Greek simulacra in gold of humble grasshoppers and bees. Exactly halfway through its length, as you'll see as I read, this opening poem turns its face away from archaic Greece, half, it has built up to the halfway point, and then begins to say the part I quoted, now days are dragon-ridden. But it does not begin with them, it begins with ancient Greece. Many ingenious, lovely things are gone that seemed sheer miracle to the multitude, protected from the circle of the moon that pitches common things about. They stood amid the ornamental bronze and stone, an ancient image made of olive wood. And gone are Phidias' famous ivories and all the golden grasshoppers and bees. We too had many pretty toys when young, a law indifferent to blame or praise, to bribe or threat, habits that made old wrong melt down as were wax in the sun's rays, public opinion ripening for so long we thought it would outlive all future days. Oh, what fine thought we had, because we thought that the worst rogues and rascals had died out. All teeth were drawn, all ancient tricks unlearned, and a great army, but a showy thing. What matter that no cannon had been turned into a plowshare? Parliament and king thought that unless a little powder burned, the trumpeters might burst with trumpeting and yet it lack all glory, and perchance the guardsmen's drowsy chargers would not prance. That's Victorian England and Ireland. Now, days of dragon-ridden, the nightmare rides upon sleep. A drunken soldiery can leave the mother murdered at her door to crawl in her own blood and go scot-free. The night can sweat with terror as before we pieced our thoughts into philosophy and planned to bring the world under a rule who are but weasels fighting in a hole. He who can read the signs nor sink unmanned into the half-deceit of some intoxicant from shallow wits, who knows no work can stand where the health, wealth, or peace of mind were spent on masterwork of intellect or hand, no honor leave its mighty monument, has but one comfort left. All triumph would but break upon his ghostly solitude. But is there any comfort to be found? Man is in love, and love's what vanishes, what more is there to say? That country round, none dared admit if such a thought were his, incendiary or bigot, could be found to burn that stump on the Acropolis, or break in bits the famous ivories, or traffic in the grasshoppers and bees. The poem ends with a return to ancient Greece and a restatement of its original enigma. The poem is then a circular one, ending in the same perplexity with which it began. The initial confidence in the permanence of ingenious, lovely things is seen as illusion, just as the confidence that a permanent peace had been established, the peace of the British Empire, you might say, and that war wouldn't break out again. That too is seen as an illusion. And at the close, the speaker's language descends to reproducing in the indirect discourse of the last three lines the attitudes natural to the destroyers. Contempt for the sacred image of Athena, that stump, what they thought when they were burning it. Mercenary motives, traffic in the grasshoppers and bees, and heedless violence to break things in bits.